It's Wednesday, December 22nd, 12:20 in the afternoon, and you're listening to the Mincing Rascals. John Williams, not here. John Hansen here. I work for Block Club Chicago and WGN Radio.
I'm Brandon Pope here, working with CW26 Chicago.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the fully recovered publisher of the Picayune Sentinel newspaper and now a contributor to the Daily Herald.
Yeah, that's huge news. I don't want to gloss over the Daily Herald thing, but fully recovered. Eric, did you have the call? I didn't even know.
I did. I was diagnosed right after Thanksgiving. We tested positive here. I had almost no symptoms at all. And got outside the 10-day protocol in order to do our Songs of Good Cheer shows. So it's run rampant through our house and our family. And nobody's been hospitalized. People are on the mend. I've got a number of friends, former colleagues who have it. It just seems to be everywhere. And I just, my new take on it is that it's just, you're not going to avoid getting it in all likelihood. And if you're vaccinated, everyone I know who's gotten it, has been double or triple vaxxed. And none of them have been hospitalized, let alone sent to the morgue. The studies that you read show that the people who are dying and being hospitalized are vastly overrepresented in the unvaccinated community. And so it's just yet another reminder of people to get the, you know, whether you're squeamish about needles or angry about the government telling you what to do, get your damn vaccines, because it's going to save your life. And it's going to also take some pressure off the hospitals that are working so hard right now to keep people healthy. So,
and boy, if you just watch the news or follow folks on Twitter, there's very, at least a couple of days ago, this very March 2020 feel about this. But then you have to stop and remind ourselves that we are in a way different place. And Eric, I think yours is like the perfect example of that. You got COVID, but because of the steps that you had taken, the precautions and the measures that were recommended and still are recommended, you're fine. So I think there's a moment that everyone has to kind of step back and realize this is not March of 2020, despite how scary it is. Although I do see a lot of people, probably the people that have been anti-vax all along, saying that, oh, well, now NBA players are getting it. Now NHL players. See, I told you everyone can get it. Yet everyone still seems, or those folks still seem to miss the point of that this vaccine will keep you out of the hospital and keep you alive. It's making my Twitter feed dumber the last couple days, Brandon. I don't know if you've noticed the same thing.
Yeah, people are trying to be like, oh, I told you so. You've got COVID and you're still vaccinated. And it's like, that's like saying, you know, oh, you shouldn't wear a bulletproof vest because it's going to give you a bruise.
Right.
Instead of, you know, preventing you from getting any type of bruise at all. But the truth is that bulletproof vest is stopping the bullet from penetrating your skin. Vaccines mm-hmm. are the exact same way. Vaccines don't mean you're not going to get COVID. It's protection against hospitalization and death. That's what bulletproof vests do. That's what seatbelts do. That's what vaccines do.
That's a terrific analogy, Brandon, which is, I don't think anyone ever promised that there weren't going to be breakthrough cases. It now seems like breakthrough cases are really easy. My eldest son had it in February, and he just tested positive again. So he was fully vaccinated. He is triple vaxxed. He had it already.
So much for that natural immunity argument.
Exactly. Or the herd immunity. It's probably not going to happen, but he's feeling fine. Yep. And that's what this is going to be about. It's not the vaccine. Yeah, you're good. You can get COVID. You can get breakthrough cases, but it's probably going to be much, much milder.
Yeah.
And that's really the takeaway here. And anyone who is crowing about the fact that, yeah, NBA players are getting it. NBA players are getting it, but I don't believe any NBA players have even been hospitalized yet.
Vastly asymptomatic, in fact, just testing positive because of the rules that were in place in the NBA, which could be changing in the NHL. The NFL already has changed their rules that they will not be testing fully vaccinated, non-symptomatic folks. We can discuss that another time, but I do want to jump into the vaccine mandate for the restaurants, which
before we do, real quick,
go ahead, Brandon.
I do want to say, Eric, glad you're doing okay. But this is also the first podcast I've been on with Eric since his beloved Wolverines beat my Ohio State Buckeyes. And so it seems like I've been dodging you, right? I gotta say congratulations on this once in a lifetime moment for your team.
hope it's not once in a lifetime, but I do think that Ohio State fans, some other people I've talked to who haven't been dodging you the way you have Ohio State fans have said, well, you know, yeah, Michigan was the better team that day, and it did restore a little bit of the luster to the rivalry, because you guys had won like 15 out of 16 games, something like that. I mean, it wasn't even much of a rivalry anymore. So I wish there could be
a vaccine to not hear from Ohio State and Michigan fans about the rivalry that very few people here in Chicago care all that much about. But I'm glad you are on the mend as well,
it's
Eric.
Illinois Northwestern. That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that terrible Packers rivalry we had.
As a side note, I also saw that Week 15 Vikings versus Bears Monday Night Football had the highest ratings on TV for Week 15 in like decades. I don't know who's watching this stuff. Anyways, before we go down the sports road too much, we can return to it later. I got to talk about the city mandate. It's something that people have been calling for a long, long time. A lot of people, not everyone, of course. Some people had hoped a lot of businesses would do it on their own. I think, Eric, you and I were in that camp, and a lot of them did. But now, as of January 3rd, all Chicago bars, restaurants, the United Center, clubs, gyms must require a vaccine and not a negative test. Employees can still get proved negative testing to still be employed there. You must be fully vaccinated to enter those places. Eric Zorn, too little, too late, make a difference, hurt businesses? Where are you at on that?
It's too little, too late. I don't understand why the mayor is waiting till January 3rd. She says businesses need to update their signage and train their workers. This is not teaching them how to do surgery, and signage is as easy as a PDF file and some masking tape. You know what I mean? I don't know what she's waiting for. This should have been done months ago. I'm glad we're doing it now, but and if it is the emergency that she seems to believe that it is, I'm not sure why she's waiting till the new year to do it, but...
Yeah, Brandon, you've been safe during this pandemic, so this statement is not about your behavior, but you're young. You used to like to go out to clubs and bars, and you know, you're still in your 20s. You're fun and hip. Will this matter for people, not being able to get into a place? Because for me, it matters to me nothing, but I don't know. What do you think?
Absolutely, it's going to matter. There is a major issue here in Chicago I've noticed recently of people feeling sick and still going out to clubs and bars, people even testing positive for COVID and still going out to clubs and bars, reckless behavior. And that's why we're getting this spread. You were talking earlier about how it feels like March 2020 all over again. Just this past week, since Tuesday, I know 18 people that have tested positive for COVID-19.
18?
18, 1-8. Wow. That's ridiculous. And I've been quarantining because there have been exposures I've run into where I went to a holiday party and finds out somebody got COVID, you know, or even with work, you find out somebody got COVID. It's unavoidable at this point. So when it comes to clubs, bars, and having this vaccine mandate, I know so many young Black Chicagoans, young Latino Chicagoans who are not vaccinated, who choose not to get vaccinated and they still go out. This is definitely going to make an impact because now there's nothing to do. All your entertainment is cut off. You can't even go to the movie theater anymore if you don't have a vaccine by January 3rd. So I'm hoping this does make a dent. I'm in this group chat for like Black millennials in Chicago and they are livid. So many are just livid. They're comparing it to Nazi Germany, even though they have no idea what Nazi Germany really was like, if they think this is Nazi Germany. This is a necessary step. It is too little too late. It does feel much belated, but it's better than nothing. And if it's going to be what it takes for people to get that shot in their arms, then so be it. But having this step is necessary. Absolutely.
I often thought, you know, well, if all these places are vaccinated, this is before Omicron, I thought this, if they're vaccinated, then fine, let's get rid of the mask mandate. But you're hearing people that feel sick and still go, because a vaccine mandate is not going to stop that. Someone could show a vaccine card, they're vaccinated, they have a breakthrough case, they feel sick, they still go to the club. That's crazy. I think that's just being a bad human, I want to say. I'm trying to give them some benefit of the doubt, but that's just a bad move.
It's being an absolute bad human, but it's also just relying on habits of the past. You know, in the past, you might have sniffles, you may have maybe a cough or something, you say to yourself, yeah, I'll still go out on Saturday night with my peeps. And but we're in a different ball game now. You can't even risk stuff like that anymore. But people are doing it. They're definitely doing it.
Is there objection to getting the vaccine rooted in paranoia about the government putting something weird into their vaccine? Is it what's the cause? Is it fear of needles? What's the cause of the hesitancy to get the vaccine at this point?
It's a lot of misinformation. It depends on who you talk to. My sister actually is still one of the people I'm trying to get vaccinated.
And really?
And I've been arguing with her back and forth the other day because she saw the Chicago mandate and she said it was draconian. And she said, this is ridiculous. Many fear the side effects. My sister was saying, oh, people are getting sick. They're getting long-term health effects from the vaccine. I showed her stuff that said that's not true at all. But this misinformation going around, people rely on it. There is a mistrust of government, but there's also a mistrust of traditional media. And so whatever traditional media says, whatever numbers are put out there, stats or figures, people just in their brain are saying, I can't really trust that. I'm going to do my own research. So it's really the misinformation is what it is. That's really what is the source of it. And people having fear of what the side effects of the vaccine are.
For me, I think the vaccine mandate for going into bars and clubs is too little too late. And I don't think it'll make any difference. But Brandon, obviously you'd seem to know people that might make a difference for. I just feel like for the most part, anyone that was going to get vaccinated was going to get boosted. Of course, a lot of people can't get booster shots right now. Those people aside, have already done it. And now you're going to be slapping $10,000 fines and you know they're going around and they're going to be looking for places. And maybe they have a law, they should enforce it. But imagine you're a small business owner and you've been struggling for 2 years and you're doing what you can. Someone finds a fake vax card or something and the guy who's 22 years old making minimum wage, we need more workers, not less. And all of a sudden they're going to have $10,000 slapped on there. I mean, this is going to really could hurt some businesses.
Oh, absolutely. That's the part where when I hear from the business community, some are embracing this because they do want to stay open, but others are fearing that right there, that high cost. But hey, we're in a ball game now where we're trying to avoid death. We're trying to save lives. So if you're not going to get on the game, hey, you lose some money. I think that's just the way it has to be.
I guess I belong to a gym and they got slapped with a fine and I've never seen for masking. I've never seen a human in there without a mask. So I think they were looking in the window, saw one person pull their mask down for a second to get some water or something like that. Or someone complained because they saw someone without a mask for a few seconds and bam, got fined. And they're struggling as it is. It worries me a bit.
You would hope that the city would be reasonable and maybe issue a warning ticket or citations before they ramp up to $10,000 fines. But in some ways, this is meant to not necessarily to punish business owners, but to give them the spine, give them the resolve to refuse entry. Because there are people who give them grief. And you hear about that all the time, where people are like a defiant customer comes in. And to have that behind you, it's like, hey, look, pal, we can't sell you alcohol because you're 16 and we can lose our license. It's better than saying, because of my personal beliefs, you can't have alcohol. So I think that's part of the reason behind this law. We'll see how it's
giving enforced. Them cover.
Gives them cover.
It does give them. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, you say that you don't think it makes a difference. I think that to the extent that it encourages or compels people to get this vaccine, which in turn lessens the severity of COVID infections in Omicron times, and then that takes the pressure off the hospitals. We're running out of ICU beds. There are places in the country that have no hospital beds for anybody right now. We're fortunately not there yet. But to the extent that it does have a snowball effect of some sort of diminishing the severity of this in the population is I think, the hope. Right now, like I said, I think everyone's going to get it, more or less, for all practical purposes, unless you're really good and it's at keeping masks everywhere and staying away from people. But most people, not only are you living your life, but you're in a lot of contact with people who are living your life so that you're, you know, you let down your guard around your friends, you take your masks off and you're sitting around in private because you've all been vaccinated. But that's not good enough now because we don't even, I mean, I was going to say with our family, we don't even know who patient zero was.
Right.
We don't know which one of us got it first and passed it to whom or where, what certain people will say, like, where'd you get it? We don't know.
Right.
My wife was the first one diagnosed and she was the most careful of all of us. So
right.
I'm not,
but you should still blame her. No, you should still blame me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Throw it right under the bus.
What I try and tell people when I'm arguing with them on Twitter, which is just a great exercise to do, everyone, is I follow your line of thinking, Eric, and just looking at what's happened with South Africa, everyone's going to get it. So which side do you want to be on? The side that in March, we're now even further along in this thing, and everyone has some natural immunity on top of herd immunity and tops of vaccination and boosters, or do you want to be dead? Or be a long hauler, right? So, like, the choice is clear for me, but I think we might be preaching to the choir a little bit.
I'm curious, one, how they're going to make sure that the vaccine cards are actually authentic or real.
No way.
I don't know if there's a way you can. But two, and let me know if you guys know the answer to this, because I haven't seen the answer yet. There are people, as far as I know, that are medically exempt from vaccines.
Right. Legitimately so.
Right. Legitimately so. Like, they just can't take it because of a medical condition. What does that mandate do to them? That's what I'm curious about.
My guess is
documentation, right?
Yeah. You can have a doctor's letter or some official letter, which of course opens the door for more potential fraud. I think this is just meant to, like every other mitigation thing, some of them way less effective than others, is just to say, hey, be a good human. There's going to be no way to get around people creating fake vaccination cards, fake documentation. People are going to do that. But if it just create, you know, maybe there's a step along the way where someone's buying a fake vax card where they say, you know, for less money and less time, I could just get the damn vaccine. If you're right, I don't want to put anyone on blast. If you ever wrote like a fake paper in college, there were times or anything like that, or if you were like really piecing something together, never read the book, and you're like looking up things on the internet to try and find out what happened in the book, I'm like, you know, it'd be quicker if I just read the book and then wrote a paper.
Did you ever write a fake fake paper in college?
No. In high school, I did get caught. This is going deep down the weeds. Zoran, this is going to make you cringe, but I did get caught right in the early days of the internet, ripping some things off the internet when it was, I thought there was no way to find it. The teacher found it. I got an F, of course, as I should have. He allowed me to pass the class still because it would have tanked me if I rewrote it. And so I got a terrible grade in that class. It was a great life lesson. Don't plagiarize, kids. So, and nowadays, software catches all that stuff pretty quickly. So, anyways, sorry, Eric. I know a Daily Herald writer would not approve of what I just said, I imagine.
No, but in college, I did get dinged for borrowing ideas from Monarch Notes, if anyone remembers Monarch Notes. They were like Cliff Notes, but they were the brand X. And I had taken some ideas, not word for word, but certainly the ideas and the And the teacher, he didn't fail me in the class either, but it was a good lesson to learn early on in life. This was way before the internet, though. So we did our papers on stone tablets.
Brandon, you asked that question so leadingly, as if you have a story of your own.
I did Spark Notes, which is, I guess, the equivalent of Monarch Notes back then. I never got in trouble for that. But the one thing I did get in trouble for, I took a photography class for some reason. And we had an assignment where you needed to take a picture of like a landscape of the campus. And I had like this old picture that I had taken a long time ago of the campus. I'm like, I'll just use that.
An old picture.
And I thought there's not going to be any harm to that, right? And he said, we're going to put these up in front of the class and we're going to talk about it. You're going to present. I'm like, oh, damn it. And sure enough, students in the class who weren't helping me out at all, like pointing out, well, why is there a crane there on campus? Like, why are there construction cones there? I'm like, oh, you know, I think they moved it over the weekend.
Hey, at least you took that picture, though. I thought you were going to say you took a picture of another picture.
No, at least I took the picture, yeah, but I still got in trouble because it was like years old.
Yeah, this is what happens when John Williams is gone. We just dive off the COVID onto our own personal stories. Hope you've enjoyed it, Mincing Rascal folks. Let's bring it back just a little bit. Just one more thing about the vaccines. I am like such a sucker for any form of bipartisanship, statesman, like Brandon, you know this. I nearly cried when Pence and Biden just elbowed each other at the 9/11 memorial while Biden was running. Anyways, Joe Biden, for the first time that I can remember, gave credit to President Trump for getting boosted in his in a press conference yesterday, not a press conference, a speech. He then gave credit to the previous administration and the science community for the development of the vaccine. That word got to President, former President Trump, who then thanked Joe Biden and said it was a very good thing. And maybe this is the path forward to healing all wounds. So my bleeding heart jumps in and goes, oh, my gosh, maybe this is the way forward. Maybe President Biden can give a little credit sometimes to President Trump on things that maybe they actually agree on. Maybe this is what heals the nation. And I already see that you both are giving me guff for this. Am I crazy, Eric Zorn?
No, you're not crazy. I've been saying this actually all along, which is I think that it was a tactical mistake of the Biden administration not to call it the Trump vaccine every once in a while and to remind his backers and supporters and cult members that this vaccine was pioneered and under the Trump administration. It was Operation Warp Speed, I think it was called.
Yep.
And you know, that's one thing I think people do give the Trump administration credit for. I mean, they mishandled a lot of things about the pandemic, but they did do a lot to encourage the development of the vaccine. And I think that if Trump had been reelected, his supporters would have been rushing to get the vaccine. And the fact that Trump has now seemed to endorse getting vaccines. He has said, oh, I've gotten the vaccine, but you don't have it. There's one thing he gave a speech a couple months ago where he said, I got the vaccine. You don't have to, though. It's okay. It doesn't, you know. And I think that he's getting more on the side of like, hey, this vaccine can help save the country and I can take some credit for it. And that's what it's all about for Trump. Right.
Right.
He cares about how it reflects on him. And maybe the light bulb has gone off over Biden's head. Like, hey, if I bring Trump into this effort and pay him the proper respect and offer him a chance to take some of the credit, he'll embrace that. And then the MAGA country, which is, if you look at the charts where people are getting this or are getting COVID, where they're being hospitalized, it tends to be in counties that supported Trump. It tends to be among Republicans. It's really bad politics for them to be killing off their own supporters it just for spite or whatever reason they're doing it. But I think it's high time that Biden did that, and I'm glad to see it. And I don't care if Trump gets credit.
Brandon, am I too pie in the sky?
We usually in
this country, if Joe Biden gives Trump a little credit,
we usually disagree on the bipartisanship stuff. But I don't think there's any harm in giving a little bit here, right? I generally think that Joe Biden's gleaming optimism of bringing people together and sides together and hashing things out is ineffective nowadays, and I think Joe Manchin has proven that. But if this is the way to maybe get some people that are staunchly against Biden just because he's Joe Biden, just because he's a Democrat, more so to be reasonable and not just be in your camp, but also open themselves up to getting a vaccine, being COVID responsible, then that's the responsible thing to do. So, it takes a big man to, you know, push aside those really, really, really stark differences and be able to do that. But he did. So I think it's a good thing. Let's just hope it's not too much.
Yeah, I don't know.
Showing up together.
I mean, there are, well, I don't even want it on this road anymore. Never mind. I was going to talk about the thing they agree on that they could work together on and maybe even invite Trump to the, never mind. Don't, no.
We don't need him back at the White House at all after January 6th.
Well, you might get him in three more years. You never know. Did you guys read the Dan Webb report on the Jussie Smollett case? And some of the pushback from the special prosecutor's office, or are we officially over the Smollett thing and couldn't even bring yourself to really read it and see what was going on there? Zorn?
I did read it. I read the whole thing. And I got to say, Kim Fox comes off really slippery, really disingenuous, really dishonest And, you know, her lawyer came out and made a couple of little pinpricks at it, saying, well, she had more discretion than Dan Webb realized. But his defense of her was very weak. Her office's statements about what she did were very weak. I keep wondering what would have happened if this report had come out last August when it was written and filed. The court held on to it until just a Monday, I guess it was. And now we get to see it, and the extent of how Fox blew this is just overwhelming to me. How she sort of fobbed it off on two deputies, and the deputies don't even agree on how things happened. She says she was really surprised when the Smollett charges were dropped. And then she admits that she was told by her, now she admits that she was told by one of her advisors, her legal, her chief policy advisors, that the way she recused herself was illegal. She admitted that she was in more consultation with the Smollett family than she had previously disclosed. And she wrote an editorial in op-ed, the Tribune, that said that there were weaknesses in the case that had developed. And she admitted now that that's a lie. She mishandled this from Jump Street. And and the thing is, of course, that she's not up for reelection for three more years, basically. Mm-hmm.
A while.
2 years and 11 months will be the next time she faces the voters. And it just isn't going to matter by then. There's so much else is going to overtake that story. But it's pretty dismaying. It's a pretty vicious, tough report on her, and reflects really poorly on her.
Hope.
Yeah, you know, it does reflect poorly. You're right. She doesn't have an election to worry about for a little bit, but I think she does owe the public an explanation on her thinking when it comes to the Smollett case. Kim Fox has obviously done a lot of great things in Cook County, but this, when you have a report that details a quote, substantial abuse of discretion. They talked about breaching an obligation of honesty, this being a major failure. Those are things that just can't be pushed aside. And her office may try to, but I guarantee you someone's going to try to bring it up as they ramp up campaigns against her. Will they be successful in those campaigns? Who knows? It depends on who runs. But this is something she needs to get in front of and explain, because it doesn't look good. And it feeds into this idea of, you know, whether it's justified or not, that the Democratic Party and people that are connected to the Democrats are part of this elitist club, getting each other off of things and erasing things away. It just adds to that whole thing. Whenever you search Jussie Smollett on Twitter, you see a lot of vile and bile about this, I don't know what you want to call it, this shadowy group of Democrats, in a sense, that are just working behind the scenes. And Jussie Smollett's a part of that, right? According to them. This does not help that at all. It only inflames things. So I think she does owe the public a very thorough explanation as to what her thinking was on this. And then we need to just move on, because, yes, I am part of the latter camp who is tired of Jussie Smollett.
She tweeted yesterday a quote from a letter to the Tribune, which is, a prosecutor has virtually unlimited discretion to decide whom to prosecute, what the charges should be, and how to resolve and dispose of criminal cases. The core of the job is discretion. Charging a prosecutor with abuse of discretion is a non sequitur. I don't think those two sentences relate to each other. Of course, you want prosecutors to have discretion. They're human beings and they should. But if it's improper discretion or applied improperly, yes, you should be able to charge them. Like, what are we talking about?
Yeah, I thought that was just lawyerly nonsense. And yes. I was surprised that she put her own lawyer up to that. Clearly, she must have read the letter before he submitted it. A prosecutor has discretion. That's true. But you can't say, I'm going to only prosecute people whose last names begin with A to M. And everybody else can go. That would be her discretion, but a complete abuse of discretion. There are all kinds of ways that a public official can abuse his or her discretion, even though they have a significant amount of discretion in their job description. So I thought that was very strange. And you notice that letter did not address the fundamental issue here, which was Fox's lack of candor, her lack of honesty, the way she lied to the public about this. And so we talk about, well, this case is over and Jussie Smollett's going to get whatever sentence he gets and we'll move on. But the public needs to have confidence in its state's attorney, that the state's attorney is going to fairly and firmly prosecute crime and keep us safe. That's part of her job. And if we can't trust her, trust is really integral to that. Well, to all public offices, but that office in particular, you got to have trust in your prosecutors.
Yeah.
And she's just squandered it all. So yeah, and that has ramifications that go beyond electoral politics, in my view.
That vote for a prosecutor was the longest I've ever stood in a ballot box. It was like out of a sitcom or out of a drama show. It was like 5 or 6 or 7 minutes I sat there and I couldn't decide. And I had read up pretty well on the case in the election. I ended up voting for her. And it's probably one of the few votes I've taken that I pretty much regretted. I ended up voting for Kim Fox because a lot of people in her community were voicing support for what she was doing. And I felt it was an important voice to have at the table and in the pillars of power, that for too long, white men have dominated Chicago politics and prosecutors' offices. And here is someone who is different. And her community says the things that she's doing are beneficial to their community. And I trusted that. And then reading through some of this stuff, I've just been like, what? I didn't make the right choice. But that's one man's opinion. Point of personal privilege. Sorry.
I voted for her also, and it was because I didn't feel like the Republican challenger she had, Pat O'Brien, was the right guy for the job. I thought that he had made some mistakes in his career. I didn't necessarily think that his, get tough, crack down approach. It's actually, frankly, looking a little better this year than it looked last year because of the way crime has gone up. I ended up, and also I thought Kim Fox, I was then at that point, I was part of the Tribune and her editorial board endorsement session. She was very impressive, aside from dodging questions about Smollett. I thought she presented herself very well. So it wasn't the easiest vote I've ever cast,
right.
I didn't wait 7 minutes to do it.
I thought I was ready. And then I had the moment. I don't know. I very, very rarely ever have that moment in the actual booth, especially during a pandemic. I should have just been in and out. But there I was, 7 minutes. Hey, I wanted to talk really quickly about the Mayor Lightfoot speech. It's a couple days ago now about violence reduction, things she wants to do. There's a lot of play now that she does want some federal help, and she didn't want that under President Trump. And a lot of people are calling out that hypocrisy, even though I think the type of help that she wants from the feds is different than what President Trump was proposing. But it's an interesting discussion there. But the thing that stood out to me the most was this, the home monitoring system, and the fact that she doesn't want murderers anymore to be let go and with just an ankle bracelet. And I thought, holy cow, we were doing that? Is anyone else? A violent offender or a person charged with a violent crime was just strapped with an ankle bracelet and re-entered back into society? What am I missing here? Did I not read this correctly, Eric?
Yeah, I don't think you were reading your news reports carefully enough. Yeah, okay. That happens. And there are numbers. I think it's up to like 5 dozen people who've been arrested on serious violence charges who were out on bond, presumably on home monitoring, or maybe not even on home monitoring, after serious accusations against them. And we've got this idea that, well, you're innocent unless proven guilty, and we can't fill up the jails with people, especially during COVID times. But there comes a time where we have to realize that the presumption of innocence is something that plays out at a trial. But when you are arrested and charged with something, the actual presumption that the system makes is that you're a dangerous person. We've charged you. We've arrested and charged you because we think that you have committed an act that put others in your family, your community, right, in danger. So we want to keep you. That's why we put them on home monitoring. That's why in older times we used to lock them up. And I think that we should continue to be more careful about who it is we let out in the community, because we're seeing the spike in crime that had Mayor Lightfoot giving that speech the other day. So, I mean, I think that she's right to do this. I think it's time to step up the or to cut back on just home monitoring as a way to incapacitate people, because it's not doing the job.
I think it's tough because, like, I am for, stopping recidivism by using prisons less for lesser sentences. And I think the majority of people have moved in that direction. And yes, the presumption of innocence should be on you in the court of law. But when you're looking at someone in front of you and what they're charged with, you have to kind of weigh the safety of the community that you might be sending them back to, realizing that they still have that presumption of innocence, but just playing the odds a little bit as a judge or someone who's issuing what happens next, the safety of the community taking a little bit heavier role in this. I don't know. It's a tough one, but I don't know. Brandon, I was shocked.
It's an interesting case for sure. When it comes to this stuff, I tend to lean on people I know who are more so in the legal world. And I got a friend, Sharon Mitchell. He's a public defender for Cook County. He was not happy with this at all. He was not happy with the proposal to limit pretrial electronic monitoring at all. He called it regressive, called it dangerous, called it unconstitutional. I got to dig into it more to figure out why exactly that itself, why he believes that. But those were his initial responses to me. He also was likening it to maybe a little bit leaning too hard into Law and Order. And the policies of the 90s that we often kind of look back on as maybe too harsh, right?
Or, like, he doesn't want the pendulum to start swinging back that way, and then we have overreaction.
I think that's what he's concerned about. I think that's what some people are concerned about with this. As far as Lightfoot's speech goes, I mean, it was a good speech. Good words. Very nice words.
Would you like to have a dictionary out, Brandon, and you were just marveling at the choice of words?
I had my thesaurus ready. I was like, oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. Very well strung together words. She talked about what activists have been saying and politicians have been saying for centuries, it feels like, that the key to stopping violence in Chicago is resources and giving resources to these areas that need them. She says that, and she said it numerous times in the speech, but where are they? That needs to be part of whatever she's doing here. And so until we see that, I'm not sure how good any violent strategy actually is going to be, no matter what federal help you bring in, no matter how many ATF agents you bring in. Are you going to address the mental health issues in this city, the closing of mental health clinics? Are you going to address the closing of community centers, the closing of these structures, the food deserts, things like that? If you don't do those things, people are, you know, humans, we are creatures of instinct, right? You're going to do whatever it takes to survive, whether that be illegal or legal. That's just how it is. And we are living in a city where there are people that feel like they have to do some really illegal things just to get by or get their family ahead or whatever. And that should never be the case. And that's why we're seeing this crisis, not just in Chicago, but also in Los Angeles and also in New York. So I want to see a resources approach. I want to see a community focused approach. This speech did not really echo that to me, other than saying, yeah, we need to have more resources. We got to actually see that action taken.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure that I buy this, all these people committing crimes are, you know, was Jean Valjean or whatever the guy is in Les Miserables, that they all are trying to just feed their families or something. I mean, I think it's just there's a
not
lot
all
of,
them. No.
Of just gratuitous violence and you know, so a lot of these carjackings and so on. I think that you're absolutely right that we need to have longer term strategies about addressing the needs in these communities. That's totally true. At the same time, you can also make sure that you have people who are really prone to violence and keep them locked up, because putting little things around their ankles isn't preventing them from committing more crimes. So I think it's both. And Austin had a good line in last week's show. We were talking about this Bucktown, this initiative in Bucktown to hire armed security guards. And he said, you know, the people in Bucktown, they did not hire extra social workers. They hired extra security guards. And I thought that was a good point, which is, you know, yeah, we do need social workers. We need mental health care. We need jobs. We need grocery stores. We need better schools. All the things are true. But while we wait for that to happen, or wait for the effects to kick in, we also need to keep people safe.
Because the effects kicking in on these changes that are proposed are not at all immediate, yet the numbers count each weekend is immediate. And that's the thing, is that if leaders are going to be, they have a plan, they're focused on, I'm not saying they do or they don't, I'm not saying ignore the numbers, but change is very incremental when you're talking about food deserts and mental health and these sorts of things. And it won't be overnight. And they can't look like they're doing nothing. This is like the problem when politics are in charge of policing, right? Because it just, there's an immediate reaction that we need from politicians, but long-term community growth is so slow. There's nothing really you can do about it. By the way, Eric, I am writing down to see if I can find a prisoner with the number 24601 to prove you wrong and see if there is a Jean Valjean somewhere in there.
Love hey, musical humor.
Yeah. Speaking of Austin Berg, I love, he's not here with us today. He's not just sitting in the corner, not chiming in yet. He isn't.
Yeah, you know, he said he had some family thing with Christmas. So where are your priorities? Where are your priorities?
How dare he?
On December 22nd.
Yes, come on. Anyway.
Breaking colon, he says, and this was a tweet he had yesterday. U.S. Census shows severe Illinois population loss in 2021. The total population in the state down 113,000 people. And I believe that's just over a year. Out migration down 122,000 people, essentially people leaving. There was a natural increase from births of 2,700 internationally to 5,800 people, but overall a very big net loss. And he immediately was countering people that said, well, COVID killed people and that there's the 2020 results didn't show something this significant. But he immediately says that those two things should be ignored and that this is very drastic shift. Illinois has currently 18 congressional districts. They'll have 17 starting in the new election cycle. Illinois is very lucky that they didn't take these numbers in 2021 as opposed to 2020, because they absolutely would have lost one more seat. So is it an overreaction? Is this a sign of people moving, COVID changes, or something drastic happened in the last year that makes you more worried about the future of Illinois' population?
Well, they got rid of Michael Madigan, which is what Austin's organization has been leading the charge for a long time. These numbers are very preliminary, and they're probably 113,000 is a huge number, and I'd like to see how it actually shakes out, because it would be a very large movement in the number compared to what it's been sort of year to year, decade to decade, and so on. The implicit argument behind this is that our taxes are too high and our weather sucks and our politicians are corrupt and our baseball teams never win the World Series anymore. I'm not sure there's all kinds of reasons. The pension debt is too high. People are moving to get away. And I think you need to take a really long historical look at this and see where were people coming in from, where are they going to, and why are they going there? Obviously, there are people who move to Tennessee or Texas, because the taxes are lower there, but also the education isn't as good there. There are a lot of things. There are reasons that people stay in Illinois that we don't really talk about, which is we have pretty great public university system. We've got Chicago is a great place to live. Austin is probably not going to move to Highland, Indiana, because he's a young man in Chicago, and Chicago is a great city. I think it's a good question. It's one that needs to be always engaged with. But I'm not quite sure that these numbers are going to hold up as the actual studies come in and we really get a sense of where people are and what they're doing. So, yeah, I'm not sure.
You're right. 12.5 million out of 12.6 million people stayed. This isn't just some huge outward migration. And we will see with the numbers. You're right. And there has to be some, I'm not talking about people dying from COVID. Of course, that contributes, but more so people wanted space. There was a lot of general trends that we see out of major cities as a whole that are playing into it that maybe aren't necessarily so Illinois specific. I don't know. Brandon?
I think when I talk to people around my age that end up leaving Chicago, and they go to Indianapolis or they go to Houston or they go somewhere else, it's just about opportunity. It's just about opportunities they get and having the opportunity to have a backyard instead of having a one bedroom, having the opportunity to have some property, having the opportunity to have some upward progression in your job. That's really what I hear the most. I don't hear about taxes. I don't hear about any of those other reasons or the World Series or anything like that. They just go where the jobs are and where they see more opportunity for growth. And for some industries, Chicago, it's a hot spot. There's no doubt. We're the number three market in the country. It's a hot spot. But when you have a hotspot like that, people aren't necessarily leaving their jobs. So when you have people that are keeping their jobs, they're in this great city and they're staying in that job for 20, 30 years, young people come in, they see, hey, there's not really a lot of upward progression for me here. Let me go see where else I can go. Indianapolis, great, let's do that. And it's cheaper to live? Oh, sweet. Simple as that.
And all okay. the wonderful concerts and plays in Indianapolis you can go see.
Oh, there's stuff in Indianapolis.
They got some good concerts out in Indianapolis.
Okay, all right. All right, but I'm saying there's a reason. And one of the things that I have heard in over the years in discussions, endless discussions about this population stuff, is that it's not that so much that people are leaving Illinois, but we're not getting the same number of people arriving in Illinois.
Right.
Illinois is not attracting people. So this is always a net number we're talking yes. about, the number of people who are born here and who move here versus people who left. And so so we're not attracting people the way maybe we used to. And that's a different kind of issue in terms of, are we attracting employers? Are we attracting research institutions, things like that, that then bring people with them? So.
Yeah. The, I don't know where this fits in the conversation, so I'm just going to throw it here. So much has been made about the national shortage of labor right now and how there are so many open jobs. And even if every single person who wasn't employed filled those jobs, we would still have a labor shortage, what they call full employment. And Joe Biden earlier this week did announce he was going to make 20,000 additional guest worker visas available this winter amid the labor shortages. And I'm surprised that hasn't been a stronger talking point for people that have always been pro-immigration, in that as Illinois loses population, as these population centers struggle to find jobs, one of the biggest sources of population growth in the United States is immigration. Studies show that our population would actually start to decrease in the next 50 or 60 years without more legal immigration. And I'm surprised that here is an opening, specifically for Democrats who want more legal immigration, that they're not using this opportunity to say, look, we have so many entry-level jobs that are open right now, whether it's kids don't want to do them or people have colleged out of them or whatever the case may be. We have millions of people that want to come to this country and go through the legal process to do so. I just cannot believe they aren't talking about this as a way to try and fix this problem.
There's a lot of opportunity the Democrats aren't taking advantage of, if we're going to be honest.
Yeah, I know. But this specifically, yeah. I've heard no rumblings of people talking about more legal immigration. All I hear about is the Texas border being, and look, there's problems at the border, do not get me wrong, that need to be addressed. They are lingering over from the Trump administration, continued policies by the Biden administration. I don't know. This could just be a tangent I went on, Eric. You don't have to comment if you don't want to, but I just don't get it.
I find it's something I didn't think about, but it's interesting. We don't push for people to come in, which is
right.
Disappointing.
Like the old South Park joke was, they took our jobs. Well, guess what? Now we need them to.
Yeah.
And
we need a workforce.
Yes. And don't even get me started on how the melting pot of the country is great. And I love it. And the more variety we have in people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is wonderful. Yes, I agree with all that. But from the pure business perspective, I'm surprised more business leaders, more pro-business people aren't saying, we need more people. You talk about paying pensions. You talk about funding Social Security. We're going to have a major problem in this country in 20 or 30 years paying for some of this stuff. We need more young bodies here.
Well, it's business interests over the years who have really stepped back from pressuring the government to crack down on immigration. That a lot of businesses rely on unskilled labor that's come across the border, whether they're here legally or illegally. And so that's why the Republican Party, although it has talked a lot about stopping immigration, only in the last few years have they really started getting serious about building the wall and really cracking down, because they know that a lot of their business owners, a lot of people who identify as Republicans who are business owners, rely on that kind of labor. And John, you're absolutely right that we do need more workers right now, and that by clamping down on immigration, by not letting people in out of some fear that the country is turning browner or whatever the reason is people are upset about, that we are making it difficult for employers, difficult for business, and it's raising prices for all of us. And, you know, all those things are happening. So,
yeah.
So the idea that these people are coming in and taking our jobs really has never been particularly true. And it's really not true now, because there's so many jobs that are unfilled.
Yeah. So 20,000 extra worker visas through, and that's not citizenship. That's a worker visa, could offer a pathway to citizenship for some folks in the winter. We'll see if that expands at all anymore. Last note I have on here is about the Thompson Center. Is it going or I cannot follow this story anymore. Every time I should set up a mute button for the Thompson Center on Twitter, because I cannot believe how much attention gets paid to one kind of interesting looking building. Oh, I'm going to get slammed for this, but leaky build. I love the food court. So what's the latest on this?
Well, the Prime Group, this is a real estate group, is going to buy it for somewhere. Is it $70 million or it's right around there, $70 million. You know, Bruce Rauner wanted $300 million for it just a few years ago. But the building is it's kind of a white elephant. Just heating and cooling that vast atrium is it's always been kind of a strange thing. I mean, it's a cathedral. It's supposed to be a temple to transparency in government, but it turned out to be a symbol for inefficiency in government, and you know, with the noise and the HVAC problems and the maintenance issues that they've had all along, that it's really a difficult building to justify hanging on to. And you know, God bless these new owners, and good luck trying to turn that into a profitable building, because you know it doesn't use the space that it has, its footprint, very efficiently. There are not that many rooms, offices in it. I'm glad we're getting rid of it. I would not have been all that sad if they had decided to raise it and build something on top of it, even though it is beautiful. It's a beautiful thing, but again, when it came in 1985, it cost twice as much as they thought it was going to cost.
Right.
And we're not recouping our costs on it. So I'm glad the state's getting rid of it. But I'm skeptical that these new owners are going to be able to turn it into a going concern.
You got a Thompson hot take, Brandon?
I mean, it's fashionable, but not functional. I think Eric summed it up really well. It can be a little bit of a headache trying to get through. I think it being renovated or upgraded or whatever is the best thing for the city, the best thing for downtown. I'm not looking forward to the construction when it happens.
Yeah, that's going to mess up the lines too, for sure.
Yeah, because you got the pink line in there.
You got everything. You got the blue line underneath. You got the all the whole line attached at Clark and Lake outside.
That's actually where I go to get the blue line for O'Hare. Yeah.
Well, then we can't mess with that. We can't have Brandon any more delayed.
One of the good things is I think that the new developers say that there's not going to be any disruption of CTA service there, because it is kind of tucked into a corner of the facility, and most of the work that they're going to be doing is out in that atrium. They're going to be trying to curtain off the rooms and the offices from all the noise and everything. So I'm guessing that they're going to not have a lot of disruption in Brandon's commute. So I'm really hoping that.
Thank goodness.
Last point I saw that there was, I forget who it was, one of the national media sports guys saying that the Bears need to rebrand. They need to ditch caring about the 1985 team and move on with their lives. I don't think that caring about the 85 team has impacted how terrible they have been. Are you even watching the Bears anymore, Eric Zorn?
I am watching the Bears. God help me. I turn them on. I usually watch them on DVR so I can skip through the commercials and catch up to live action. But I do watch them. I don't care about them in this deep way that a lot of Bears fans care about them, because I've sort of over the years gotten used to the fact that they're basically mediocre. They've had a couple of good years, but it's been a long time. We were in the Super Bowl in the early 2000s at one point, but they got clobbered then. And Phil Rosenthal, my former colleague at the Tribune, he tweeted on Monday night, he goes, you know, Aaron Rodgers, when he said that he owned the Bears, I own you. Remember, he said that to the fans.
Yeah.
I own you. He says, like, he must be really, really dismayed as an owner to be watching this game. that was awful on Monday night. They were just bad. And I, you know, there's COVID had hit them and so on. But there's a sense that to me, I feel like that the McCaskey-Hallis family just needs to move on, give it to some new owners, give it to some new blood. They need to get rid of Ryan Pace. They're going to get rid of Matt Nagy for sure. It's going to be a big, long turnaround project.
Are there young people that like the Bears? Like, I think that's part of the rebrand thing, right, is that everyone's like, oh, the 85 Bears. Well, I was one when that happened, and now I'm approaching 40. I'm approaching middle-aged people, and – I don't remember it. So
yeah,
are they missing out on a new group of fans that could help propel them to full capacity? I don't know, Brandon. I'm clearly out of my league talking about the Bears to a Browns fan.
Yeah, those Browns. Well, so the 85 Bears point is very interesting. I've never heard that before, but I think it does factor into this idea that the Bears organization is stale and kind of behind the times. The modern day NFL, you got to have a great quarterback or at least a serviceable quarterback, and it's all about passing games. The defenses, they've curved the rules to where defenses really can't defend the pass that much anymore. So the old school 85 Bears way of like, oh, we're going to pound the rock. We're going to run the football and just rely on good defense and have a quarterback that's just kind of so-so. That's not the way to win in the NFL anymore. It hasn't been that way for 10 years, maybe even 12 or 15. So in that sense, being stuck in the 80s is bad. As far as rebranding, though, I don't know how you would brand the team differently. You have to have that historical identity. You have to. Every team relies on their history and their culture. And I feel like the Bears themselves do a good job marketing the team. It's just a bad product. Yeah. Marketing a bad product right now. So the product on the field has to improve. Then you don't got to worry about, oh, they're relying too much on the 85 nostalgia. I think the mentality of that organization from the GMs to the ownership down needs to get out of the 80s mindset NFL-wise of a running back being your star. You need to get to a primary offensive system where the quarterback and your receivers and your tight ends are what lead the way, and the Bears are a long way off from that.
Do you think that moving to a spiffy new stadium in Arlington Heights would make a difference in terms of re-energizing the fan base?
Absolutely, because if you go to a Bears game now, the common complaint is that it's not really a home field advantage. Like teams that come into Soldier Field don't really feel intimidated. The sound isn't that deafening compared to these newer stadiums you go to. So, one, it helps your team, but also people like new stuff. We want to be able to, you know, go to restaurants and bars and hang out at the stadium, right? And tailgate and things like that. So, yeah, they got to definitely update with the times with that for sure. That's why I'm pro Arlington move. And I think it's better for Chicago overall, because if you want to have two NFL teams, which I think is where we're going in Chicago, there's Soldier Field. Now you got two lanes right there. You can have more lucrative money. You got more options. And I think it raises the profile of the city too.
We'll see. All right. That's all the notes I had on my page. We went normally I'm really quick with John Gaughan. I like to be in and out in 35 minutes, people. I don't know if anyone wants to listen to an hour and 15 minutes of us babbling on, but they do every week, and we appreciate you guys doing it. We're out today, though. Eric Zorn, of course, thank you, and Brandon Pope, nice work as well. And we'll drop another – oh, big thanks to Aleph Garris and Ashley Byhun, our producers at WGN Radio, and we'll drop another pod on you next week. Bye.
Thank you. Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.